put on goggles or turn away. Do not remove goggles or face first until fireball dissipates. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The shock wave will arrive shortly. Keep firm footing until wave passes.
From the nuclear wasteland, welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The battle for Idlib begins. How many civilians have to die before Assad gets his country back? In our series, Getting to Know the Israeli Cabinet this week, the Defence Minister, Avigdor Lieberman. What's he been saying recently? And Swedish elections on Sunday after a raft of attacks and street fighting, supposedly by migrants across the country, with the anti-immigration Swedish Democrat Party. Will they romp home as a result? And also Idlib, what could be the final assault of the Syria war is beginning? What are the most likely outcomes after Aleppo, Ghouta, Mosul and other cities which have been liberated from ISIS? Will there be a pretext for the United States to intervene? Hang on, there are US troops in Syria anyway, and probably British too, so what are they up to? What will Israel's role be? Will the terrorists succeed in getting as many of their civilian human shields killed as possible? And if Damascus was the Stalingrad of the war on terror, what will happen now the US, Saudi Arabia and Israel realise they've lost the great prize, the overthrow of Assad, the takeover of Syria and the control of the Middle East? Last, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon on Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, a new comedy night, the People's Comedy for the end of the year. And also retired Anglican minister Sue Parfitt has just returned from Hebron. What's life like there? That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. Or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. Well, let's start with Idlib, Martin. The battle seems to be just beginning. A few skirmishes, mostly bombing by the Russians from the air. So there's a lot of talk, isn't there, about the million or so civilian, even just a million children that are going to be caught up in this.
Well, there is. I mean, but when the Americans were bombing Raqqa in Iraq, Amnesty International made it absolutely clear that it was totally indiscriminate bombing which killed thousands and thousands of civilians. So they're not really in a position to lecture the Russians about what they should or shouldn't do in Idlib. And what I would suggest to you is it's taken so horrifyingly long for the Syrian Arab Army to retake control of the country, because they do take a great deal of care to try and they try to negotiate. I mean, a lot of the people in the militants in Idlib have been taken from other parts of the country and given free passage to Idlib so that they can just get them out of the way to avoid civilian casualties.
So this led to quite a lot of the fighters from other parts of Syria finding themselves in Idlib.
It's the final cauldron in which they've all been put in there. And of course what happened previously in various other parts of the country is they said, look, if you just get on some buses, you can take your weapons with you and you can go to Idlib. And then on that basis people have made the decision to leave and go to Idlib. And of course that's been a policy of the Syrian army from the beginning. They don't really want to fight people. They'd rather have either surrendered or just went home. And of course, that's the right policy. If you can persuade people just give up and go away, because a lot of them are foreigners, they're not actually from Syria. They've been infiltrated into Syria via Turkey, and they've been armed by the British and the Americans and the Israelis.
So there's about 1.5
Al-Qaeda.
About 1.5 million people in Idlib, but they're not all terrorists, are they?
No, they're the people who live there, who haven't fled. And of course, some of them will be supportive of the terrorists, whatever you want to call them. They see themselves as freedom fighters, no doubt. They are Al-Qaeda. This is quite clear. The Al-Nusra Front is in charge of Idlib, and they are Al-Qaeda. You know, the ones who are supposed to have attacked the World Trade Center, but the Americans are saying, you know, that you don't. Trump said, "Oh, don't attack Idlib because it's going to be a humanitarian catastrophe." And it's like, well, you were quite happy to level Raqqa to rubble, and there's still thousands of bodies underneath it.
Well, two wrongs doesn't make a right.
No,
civilians supposed to do?
Well, what the Russians and the Syrians have done in previous situations, they said we will open up humanitarian corridors so that people can leave before the fighting starts. But what happens usually is that those corridors are opened up, people try to leave, and then they're attacked by the Al-Nusra Front, and they shoot at them and bomb them, so they daren't leave their houses. That's what happened in Douma. People were basically living in their basements for years because the militants had taken complete control of the area.
Okay, on Justin Raimondo's antiwar.com, there's a few points he's making today. All these, today's news stories. Trump has okayed an indefinite military presence in Syria. Now, this is a big turnaround from 8 months ago or so, back in April, when he was saying, okay, it's time to get the troops out, isn't it?
Well, that was Trump's. As we all know, Trump shoots from the hip. He doesn't consult. And basically, the Pentagon decides his policy. And he just goes, yeah, okay. That's the reality. He tried to buck that to some extent to begin with, but now he knows that he can't do that. So he just agrees with what they say.
Does the US have a legitimate presence in Syria? Because obviously, they've not been invited in by the Syrian government.
Well, they've got no basis to be there in international law.
So who has invited them into Syria?
Nobody's invited them. They've invited themselves. And of course, they've been the ones who've been... the Syrian army captured an ISIS commander today, and he said, well, I was actually trained by the Americans at Al-Tanf.
So effectively, the Americans have invaded Syria.
From the Syrian point of view, yes, they've got no legal basis to be there. And I would say to any British or American military personnel in Syria, if you are killed, there is absolutely no comeback whatsoever. You're not supposed to be there. You are breaking international law. And if somebody puts a bullet through your head, then your children will just have to cry.
The Russians also today have warned the United States that the Syria offensives are planned near US positions. Whilst most of the Syrian war is centred at this point around Idlib, the last major rebel bastion, there's also interest in mopping up some of the smaller rebel positions along the Jordan border, especially where ISIS and Al-Qaeda are concerned. This is raising a dangerous risk of a confrontation between the US and Russia, because Russia and Syria are very keen to chase some of the Islamists off of the border in the near future. So this is actually from CNN. This is not just about Idlib. The Russians are saying, look, if you don't want to get killed, the Americans, you better get out of the way.
Yeah, and of course the other thing is that Bolton and others have been saying, and Nikki Haley have been saying, oh, they're going to use chemical weapons. But if they use any chemical weapons, then we will make a super hard strike against them, blah, 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 blah. And of course, there's no evidence that the Russian Ministry of Defence has actually given information to their NATO partners, saying, well, look, we've got evidence that the Al-Nusra Front have smuggled loads of chemical weapons into Idlib. You're encouraging them to stage a false flag chemical weapons attack, as we've seen before in Syria. And this, of course, may have some bearing on the release of these videos concerning Salisbury. And then they're already flagging up, but when it happens, we're going to hammer you really hard. And the Russians are saying, well, if you do that, we're going to hit back. And we will have a situation where British armed forces are in direct confrontation with the Russians. And again, since they're not supposed to be there, it's good luck to Russia, and you boys are going to have to die.
Right, Israel also, from antiwar.com, Jason Ditz, this is the Israel armed and funded 12 different Syrian rebel groups, he says. The rebels assumed Israel would save them during the southern offensive. New reports on Israel's arming and funding of Syrian rebel groups reveals that no less than 12 rebel factions, all in southern Syria, were on the receiving end of Israeli aid. This included weapons and ammunition, money, and even armoured vehicles. The story about arming Syrian rebels actually broke on Wednesday with the Jerusalem Post, though Israeli military censors shut this down quickly. So there's a page on the Jerusalem Post that popped up and then rather quickly disappeared. But Haaretz has reported it. Israel secretly armed and funded 12 Syrian rebel groups. That's on the Haaretz newspaper. Israel supported the rebel groups to push Iranian-backed forces and ISIS fighters away from the Israeli border, Foreign Policy reports. Now, I mean, surely, actually, if the Iranians are running around inside Syria, it's quite legitimate for the Israelis to say, well, we're going to have to send somebody in to make sure the Iranians keep well away from our borders.
Well, except that the Syrians invited them there and the Israelis are not invited. And don't forget, the Israelis seized the Golan Heights in 1973. They're not supposed to have them, but they've still got them. And they ought to just give them back, but they haven't. And, of course, if they did give them back, they wouldn't be in a position to support all of these. And, of course, these are radical Islamist groups they're supporting with an ideology, dare I say it, an anti-Semitic ideology. But, of course, they're basically pro-Saudi, a lot of these groups. And the Saudis and the Israelis basically are on the same side. And I think any Muslims who believe that the Saudi Arabians represent anything to do with decent Islam are absolutely deluded.
And absolutely on the point you made earlier, Martin. This is just a couple of days earlier this week, sorry, yesterday, Thursday, Reuters saying the United States has evidence of Syria. Actually, looking at this headline, it's funny, isn't it? I just read that the United States has evidence. It says the headline says the United States has seen evidence, which is quite different to actually having evidence. It's like someone showed it to us and then took it away. But anyway, the US has seen evidence of Syria preparing chemical weapons in Idlib, says one of the envoys. There is, quotes, lots of evidence that chemical weapons are being prepared by Syrian government forces in Idlib in northern Syria, the new US advisor for Syria said on Thursday, as he warned of the risks of an offensive in the country's last big rebel enclave. This is Reuters. I'm very sure we have very, very good grounds to be making these warnings, said Jim Jeffrey. Jeffrey with a J, who was named on August the 17th as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's special advisor on Syria, overseeing talks on political transition in that country. So there we have it, the warning that Assad, Syrian forces have and are preparing chemical weapons.
Well, so Nikki Haley said the same thing, John Bolton said the same thing, no doubt some factotum from the British government is parroting exactly the same line. Now, the fact is there's no evidence whatsoever that they use chemical weapons in Douma. The chemical weapons inspectors went in there and said there's not a shred of evidence that chemical weapons were used. And in actual fact, I don't believe the Syrian government has used chemical weapons at all. That why would they? They don't. They're winning using conventional arms. What do chemical weapons give them their conventional weaponry doesn't allow them to do?
Even if the Syrians don't have chemical weapons, the Russians do.
The Russians have dismantled all their chemical weapons
them?
Well, no, I don't necessarily believe anything, Tony. I don't believe anything that anybody says. But the fact is that there's no incentive for them to use chemical weapons in Idlib or in Salisbury. It's a trope of the Western intelligence services. Oh, they're using weapons of mass destruction. In actual fact, using conventional bombs, NATO absolutely destroyed Raqqa and killed thousands and thousands of civilians. The Israelis used white phosphorus in Gaza, as did the US when they were attacking Fallujah. This is just hypocrisy of the highest order. These foreign fighters that have been infiltrated into Syria are armed, trained, and directed by Western intelligence services.
And you're going to be
your taxes paying for Al Qaeda to kill people in Syria.
You're going to be telling me next that the Novichok in Salisbury came from Porton Down, our very own chemical weapons.
We don't even know there was any Novichok, Tony. There's a big question about the whole thing,
isn't it? How this narrative is building up over Idlib and also at Baqa at home as well.
I suggest that the release of these so-called videos of these chaps, supposedly the culprits, they must have had these videos for ages if they're genuine. Why now?
Well, they've released it, surely, when Parliament is open. But hang on,
they released it because there's about to be a chemical weapons false flag in Idlib, and then the RAF are going to take their planes off from Akrotiri and bomb the Syrian army, but they might get shot down. So as I said earlier, get ready to cry, people.
Let's have a listen to Theresa May's statement on Wednesday, just after Prime Minister's questions, and then we'll hear from Jeremy Corbyn his reply about the announcement that two Russians are being charged with the attack.
They haven't been charged. No, the finger's been pointed, but they haven't made any formal charges.
But they have enough. Okay, so they have enough.
Oh, they haven't got enough for formal charges, Tony.
Well, let's see what Theresa May has to say now we've heard Martin's view.
This morning, the police have set out how the two Russian nationals travelled under the names of Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Bushirov, names the police believe to be aliases. They arrived at Gatwick Airport at 3 p.m. on Friday the 2nd of March, having flown from Moscow on flight SU2588. They travelled by train to London Victoria, then on to Waterloo, before going to the City Stay Hotel in Bow Road, East London. They stayed there on both Friday and Saturday evenings, and traces of Novichok were found in their hotel room. On Saturday the 3rd of March, they visited Salisbury, arriving at approximately 2:25 p.m. and leaving less than 2 hours later at 4:10 p.m. The police are confident this was for reconnaissance of the Salisbury area. On Sunday the 4th of March, they made the same journey, travelling by underground from Bow to Waterloo Station at approximately 8:05 a.m. before continuing by train to Salisbury. The police have today released CCTV footage of the two men, which clearly places them in the immediate vicinity of the Skripal's house at 11:58 a.m., which the police say was moments before the attack. They left Salisbury and returned to Waterloo, arriving at approximately 4:45 p.m. and boarded the underground at approximately 6:30 p.m. to Heathrow, from where they returned to Moscow on flight SU2585, departing at 10:30 p.m. Mr. Speaker, this hard evidence has enabled the Independent Crown Prosecution Service to conclude they have a sufficient basis on which to bring charges against these two men for the attack in Salisbury. The same two men are now also the prime suspects in the case of Dawn Sturgis and Charlie Rowley too. There is no other line of inquiry beyond this. And the police today have formally linked the attack on the Skripals and the events in Amesbury, such that it now forms one investigation. There are good reasons for doing so. Our own analysis, together with yesterday's report from the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, has confirmed that the exact same chemical nerve agent was used in both cases. There is no evidence to suggest that Dawn and Charlie may have been deliberately targeted, but rather were victims of the reckless disposal of this agent. The police have today released further details of the small glass counterfeit perfume bottle and box discovered in Charlie Rowley's house, which was found to contain this nerve agent. And the manner in which the bottle was modified leaves no doubt it was a cover for smuggling the weapon into the country and for the delivery method for the attack against the Skripal's front door.
Well, we need to look at things like timelines. Stuff I've been reading today by Craig Murray, the former ambassador of Uzbekistan, suggests that they couldn't have been in Salisbury at the time necessary to have tampered with the doorknob, which is, in other words, they could still have done it, but they couldn't have done it via the doorknob. But
are you talking about the amount of time the
Skripals left the house at 9 a.m. and these guys didn't arrive until, as she said, 2:30 in the afternoon. Okay, so they may have had contact with the Skripals, but not through the doorknob. That's what seems to be appearing. Now, it could be that they were trying to make contact with the Skripals because the Skripals switched their phones off and were not actually, you know, they seemed to be avoiding surveillance, yeah? And it could be that these guys were coming to meet them for some reason. Now, the other point about all of this is, who's got an interest in making Russia look bad? And you know who's the first suspects that spring to my mind? The Ukrainian secret services. The people that probably murdered Alexander Zakharenko, the head of the Donbass Republic this week with a bomb, possibly helped by British intelligence services, so that we've definitely got a murder there, and not carried out by the Russians probably. And of course the other thing is it would be relatively easy for Ukrainian intelligence operatives to go to Moscow, fly through, and of course the British intelligence services would know all about this, and they will wait until they're ready to bring this out.
It's not easy for the Ukrainian intelligence people to run around in Russia, because the Russians aren't going to...
Well, no, it depends, doesn't it? I can imagine. Don't forget that these two countries used to be one country. Everybody speaks the same language. It's quite straightforward. And I'm not saying that is what happened, but people have got to think beyond. Operation Beluga was grasped up to us by Paul Burrell, the head, a senior French anti-terrorist officer, about 18 months ago. He's basically said, well, there's an operation to discredit the Russians run from inside the British intelligence services, including the NATO intelligence service, called Operation Beluga.
Can I just correct you, by the way, over the charging?
Yeah.
The arrest warrants have been issued, international arrest warrants, and the two have been charged, Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Boshirov,
Can I just mention this thing about...
Conspiracy to murder and attempted murder of former double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia.
Well, okay, but I mean, the point that I take your point, but they haven't put in an extradition request to the Russians because there is no extradition treaty.
Well, which is where we come to Jeremy Corbyn and his response to statement on Wednesday by Theresa May.
Given today's announcement on the decision to charge two Russian citizens with responsibility for this appalling attack, what steps is the Prime Minister taking to secure cooperation from the Russian government in bringing them to trial? The OPCW's... This is a serious matter, Mr. Speaker, and I think they should be brought to trial. The OPCW's findings... OPCW's findings of the evidence that Novichok was used in Salisbury are a stark reminder that the international community must strengthen its resolve to take effective action against the possession, spread, or use of chemical weapons in any circumstances. No government anywhere can or should put itself above the international law. The Prime Minister previously outlined that the type of nerve agent used was identified as being manufactured in Russia. The use of this nerve agent is a clear violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention and therefore a breach of international law. Mr. Speaker, based on the OPCW findings, the Russian government must give a full account of how this nerve agent came to be used in the UK. Will the Prime Minister continue to pursue a formal request for evidence from the Russian government under Article 9(2)? It is in the interest of the peace and security of all people and all countries that no government plays fast and loose with the international human rights rules-based system. Can the Prime Minister update the House on what contacts, if any, she's had with the Russian government more recently to hold it to account? Our response as a country must be guided by the rule of law, support for international agreements and respect for human rights, even and perhaps especially when other countries don't respect those agreements.
Well, I mean, when Jeremy Corbyn there says that it was Russian Novichok, I understand that Porton Down had said, "Well, we can't say that it was Russian." So, in other words, he's rather given away something that he shouldn't necessarily have given away there. Novichok is actually anybody can make it. Actually, the guy who invented it,
I can tell you, I couldn't.
Well, no,
you've got to have access to a... Listen, Martin, for a second. You've got to have access to a chemical plant, which is the sort of thing which is in many countries, but not even necessarily most countries, which can manufacture organophosphate pesticides. So there's not many of those plants around.
No,
you've got to be quite clever, or you've got to be quite good in a university laboratory.
This whole term Novichok refers to the guy who supposedly invented it, defected to the US, and even wrote a technical book about how to make it, which is available on the internet. Now, I would suggest that the Ukrainian secret services would be the sort of people who would have access to small amounts of Novichok if they wanted to have access to it. And of course, there's a real question whether it really was Novichok, because if it was Novichok, half of Salisbury would be dead. They've managed to completely fail in killing their supposed targets and managed to bump off random people instead. Now, I would suggest that this may be all theatre orchestrated by Western intelligence services. The same intelligence services that probably orchestrated the death of Zakharenko in the Donbass this week. The same intelligence services which probably carried out the massacres in the Maidan Square, because there's already been a court case in Kiev which pointed the finger firmly at mercenaries from Georgia in the pay of NATO who carried out those murders.
Let's just look at the statement on Wednesday this week, not years and years ago. You've got two photographs, both taken of these... this couple, Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Boshirov, both coming through customs. Now, the most amazing thing is that the photos have almost exactly the same... Well, they have exactly the same timestamp. Timestamp. Now, Craig Murray has accepted, well, they could have possibly have come through two different channels at exactly the same second.
Yep.
But it's a little bit much to make us believe that that timestamp is genuine.
Well, I think people who know about how to analyse videos will be looking at whether they've been tampered with in any way. The point is that this whole thing could be theatre, because there's an Operation Beluga which came into
I'm not interested in that speculation. We've just heard that. Is there anything else that you've seen to do with the evidence delivered on Wednesday
I think we need to look at what Craig Murray's been doing. He's looking at the timeline.
Let me just help you out here, because they haven't made it clear what visas these guys came in on.
Yeah.
Well, you need to know all these basic
things. Yes, indeed, and they must have provided fingerprints to get the visas. So why can't they give the fingerprints to the Russians are saying, well, give us the fingerprints and we'll try and trace these people, but you've got to cooperate
now,
with us.
The Russian spokesperson, Maria Zakharova, has said Theresa May doesn't even seem to read the press. Why is she saying that?
Well, I don't know why she said that.
She's living in an information vacuum that she doesn't seem to know.
I don't know why she said that.
About her own
What's interesting, and Craig Murray's already picked up on this, if these are the perpetrators, then it couldn't have been done on the doorknob. Yeah, so the doorknob story has to go, and they have to find some other explanation of what they were doing. And of course, even so, it's still very, very suspicious, because if you touch Novichok, you die. And why would they leave traces of it in their hotel room? Why would there be traces of it? If it's inside a sealed container, why would they get it out until they were going to use it? And of course, that's the same as the polonium that was found all over the place after the murder of Litvinenko. And some traces of polonium were found in Berezovsky's office, now, the main opposition to Putin.
Polonium was found in his office by the police. This is rather like, as tensions are ramping up between NATO and Russia in Syria, so they are on the domestic front, on the home front. And you may be right. Maybe it is theatre, and this is a way of ramping up tensions here in the UK. Of course, the more Russians we can expel, or the Americans can expel, the less possibilities there are for diplomatic settlements when it comes to war.
It also means that if we do decide to strike in Syria, you've already softened the British public up, oh well, we've got to do it because of what happened in Salisbury. Never mind that in actual fact it's none of our business to be sticking our fingers in Syria. But there you go.
Well, back to Syria, and here's Mike Thompson on the World Service giving a report of the sorts of conditions and preparations going on in Idlib right now for this assault by the Russians and the Syrians.
When Syrian government tanks began reinforcing their frontline positions around Idlib late last month, civilians knew what to expect. Many, like White Helmet's civil defence volunteer Ismail Abdullah, have seen it all before in other previously rebel-held areas.
The people frightened of the coming days. They stopped everything, waiting for what is going to happen. Now we're hearing that the NGOs, most of them have stopped.
So what help will there be for people?
That is the question that no one has an answer.
Turkish forces, which back some of the rebel groups in Idlib, have set up a string of observation posts around the province, though it's yet unclear what part, if any, they'll play in protecting civilians.
Many civilians counting on Turkey to stop this bombing, to stop this fighting, to stop everything.
Are you counting on Turkey?
No. From my experience, SAS forces and Russians do not care about civilians. All they care about to recapture all Idlib.
Well, we just heard what's happening there. The so-called civilian person that's telling us what's going to happen is from the White Helmets, which was founded by a British former intelligence officer called James Le Mesurier, based in Turkey. Yeah. They've had millions of pounds of your taxes to swan around pretending to rescue people, and it looks as if they staged the false flag chemical weapons attack in Duma, which turned out to be no such thing. And therefore, we've now got a sealed loop. So, British journalist, paid for by the BBC, talks to White Helmets activist, who's actually paid for by the British government, to say, oh, this is terrible, they're going to use chemical weapons on us, it's about time for the RAF to scramble. Even though this is a country which has nothing to do with us, and the Syrian army represents the democratically elected government. They won the election in 2012, they held one, even though there's a civil war, and people around the world who were Syrians were allowed to vote, apart from in this country, lots of them in Lebanon. There were pictures of thousands of people pouring into the Syrian embassy to vote for Assad.
You could actually say that President Assad in Syria has far more support than Theresa May does here.
Indeed. Indeed. I don't think there's any doubt about that. In actual fact, he's turned into, lots of people were not very happy with the regime, but because of all the things that have happened, the regime is probably stronger now than it's ever been in terms of people's perception of it. And of course, what do you do when terrorists, many of them from outside the country, Chechnya, Uyghurs from inside China, lots of Libyans, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which were sent into Syria via Turkey, and they've all been armed and trained by our special forces. This is Al-Qaeda. And of course, Al-Qaeda is supposed to be the enemy. They're going to blow us all up. But here we are going on, oh, the White Helmets are aligned with the Al-Nusra Front. They're a front for Al-Qaeda, paid for by our taxes. Why are we doing that? Because we've always been supporting Al-Qaeda. As the Russian General Staff, no. As the Iranian General Staff, no. Israel and the West and Al-Qaeda are all the same thing.
Idlib is near Turkey. It's on the sort of north of Syria. But Erdogan doesn't really see eye to eye with Putin over this, does he?
Well, I think what's happening is there's lots of discussion going on behind the scenes. As I said to you earlier, the Syrian army would prefer these people to just go. Yeah, we don't actually want to storm in there and blow everything up. We want you to just go. And I think there's also discussions with Erdogan and the Russians rather than with Assad to say, well, look, some of the rebels are not that bad and we're prepared to let them stay as long as they stop fighting us. And that's been the position all along. We don't actually want to fight anybody. If you put your weapons down and go home or just surrender, then that's good enough for us. And we won't take any further action against you. A policy which has worked very well for them. Instead of taking a kind of punitive approach, the attitude has been, look, we'd rather you just give up. We don't really want to kill you or anybody else. Just go away and stop doing what you're doing.
What is it that drives these jihadists, the terrorists, on?
Well, the ISIS guy that was captured by the Syrian army this week said, well, basically, I was paid. Basically, they paid me. They gave me a load of money,
really,
and that's
where
I said, will you fight for us? And I said, okay.
And what's the British involvement? We've got troops on the ground. We had somebody killed a few months ago, didn't we?
Yeah, that was up in the SDF-controlled region. It's not quite clear who did that. It was possibly locals, because many of the locals aren't very happy about the Kurds taking over.
So where are the Brits and the Americans?
Well,
and what are they up to?
The special forces will be scattered around all over the place. I'll bet you they're inside Idlib. And, of course, what the Russians are saying is that the British intelligence services are going to coordinate the chemical weapons attack inside Idlib. And, of course, Trump's not a bit of a wild card, so the British get to do the job to keep the Americans in the game, because the British are very much aligned with the anti-Trump CIA faction. That's the way I read it, insofar as you can read
it. Is it sort of cut out where they hold their hands up and say the Americans can quite honestly say, nothing to do with us, Governor?
Well, no, it's just plausible deniability. Everybody knows it's all linked, but you can just say you can say it's not linked to us, even though in fact it is. Now, I would suggest that if there is any so-called chemical weapons attack in Idlib, the most likely and the Russians have even been quite specific. They've said they've kidnapped some children that they're going to kill and so on. Yeah, so they've tried to actually pin it down. They've given names, they've talked about where the stuff came from, where it's being stored, because they've got their intelligence operatives working inside Idlib, as you can imagine. So if it does play out exactly as they said, then we'll be hearing from the rooftops, oh, chemical weapons, chemical weapons, chemical weapons. That's why we've got to intervene. Now, of course, when the West was and the Iraqi armed forces, but particularly the US Air Force, were raising Raqqa to the ground, nobody turned a hair, and we never saw any photographs. And of course, people are dying in Yemen every day. When are we going to have a no-fly zone in Yemen to stop the British supplied weaponry being used to kill children? Maybe we should do something about that.
Okay, what about in Brazil? We've heard today that there's a stabbing of one of the presidential candidates. Now, I seem to remember the last presidential election, one of the main candidates, leftist, was killed, in fact.
I don't remember. What, in Brazil?
This was in Brazil, yeah. The last presidential elections about four or five years ago.
I'll have to look at
it. Maybe it was a plane crash.
I think what's happened here is that he's a very...
It's a bit dangerous standing for president in Brazil, isn't it?
Well, it's dangerous anywhere to be a political active, isn't it? You know, I mean, he's a very right-wing guy. And Dilma Rousseff, who again has been used to be the president, and she was busted out by Lawfare, basically. Lula is ahead in the opinion polls. He's been twice president. It's a judicial coup, that's right. Lula is ahead, even though he's in prison on trumped-up corruption charges, he is ahead in the opinion polls. And he can't stand because of these trumped-up corruption charges. But he's ahead in the opinion polls. And I think the Workers' Party, they were going to get people to write his name in, but instead they've put somebody else to stand... whose name I've forgotten, who's second in the opinion... Lula's ahead in the opinion polls. This far-right guy who...
Well, Lula, just announced yesterday, Lula is set to give up his run for the presidency.
Yeah, because it's just become impossible for him, even though he's ahead in the opinion polls. It's ridiculous, really. Somebody's ahead in the opinion polls, he's twice been president of the country, but he can't stand because American-backed Lawfare has removed him from the political equation.
Well, Lula's heir, the person he, as he backed down, was going to back, his name is Fernando Haddad. Yeah. He has just been charged with corruption ahead of these polls.
Oh, so in other words, the only people who are allowed to stand are the far right, who are in favour. He openly said Workers' Party people should be assassinated. He was in favour of the military dictatorship. And Dilma Rousseff, after he was attacked, various other people said, well, this is terrible, because it is terrible.
The courts are deciding who runs the country, not the people.
Well, indeed. And the whole thing is rigged. And Dilma Rousseff, who was actually tortured by the military government in the 1960s, wasn't prepared to be forgiving towards this guy who's been stabbed. She was saying, well, if you talk hatred, then you get hatred is what you get back. And, of course, she got some criticism for that. But don't forget, she's not been allowed to stand. She could have been the candidate, but she's not been allowed to stand.
Well, it's only...
And she was tortured by the people that he praises.
It's only 207 million people that this person is going to be governing, whoever wins. But it doesn't sound as if the people are going to get hardly any choice whatsoever.
Well, in Latin America, the whole of Latin America is going down the drain because of the emerging market crisis. The left-wing governments that managed to improve conditions for people over the last decade and a half have all been basically had their legs broken, and things are not looking good. But of course, what ultimately
who is interfering is surely the United States, things like AmeriCom, which is the command of it purports to be the American military branch of the Pentagon, which runs both North and South America.
Yes. Well, I mean, nobody in Latin America who's got any political sense at all doubts for a moment that the Americans, the United States, try to run everything.
Yeah, because if you go to South America, you find they get rather irate if you talk about America, because of course they like it to be called the United States or North America, not us.
Well, indeed,
they see themselves as very, very different.
But the United States has only tolerated democracy in Latin America, provided it doesn't do anything they don't like, which is why the military governments came to power in the 60s and 70s and then stayed in power for 20-odd years, and why they've got rid of all these people they don't like.
Let's swing a few thousand miles east over to Sweden, because this election on Sunday is looking fascinating. Very much like our general election last year, a whole load of strange terrorist-type incidents in the run-up to the election, Martin.
Well, they're not so much terrorist incidents like ours. They're more like kind of social fighting, aren't they? So the burning of cars, stabbing,
street fighting, riots, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but it's not the same as the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group.
It's not Manchester Arena and Dawn Waddy's peculiar person that was sitting next to her that was reported twice to security in the Manchester Arena, and they said, oh, well, how would you like to be reported to the security? Yeah. So what do you make of this? I mean, they're saying that the centre-left party looks just as if it might squeak in, but I wonder whether this is not another Trump Brexit-style election where the pollsters are simply not recognising that the right may win here.
No, I think that's wrong. They will do well, but they won't win. That's them talking themselves up. Countries like Sweden used to have a very, very liberal atmosphere, and it's gradually been poisoned by modern neoliberal economics. When the right wing took power in Sweden in the 1990s, for the first time in decades, they deregulated the banking system, which then almost immediately crashed, and then the government had to come in and bail the banks out.
So what you've got is a sort of centre-left and centre-right party, which have been there for decades and decades.
Yeah.
What happens is you get one of these, what they call populists, populists, which I don't like that term at all, but it's the nationalist parties who want to limit immigration. If they get themselves a slice of votes, then they actually, what happens is they become like the DUP. They can control the balance of power.
Potentially, yes, but at the same time, what tends to happen is that the more liberal forces in the society won't let them into the government. It's happened in Austria. In Austria, the far right have won the election. The kind of people that like Adolf Hitler, because the polls, they don't like to say so, but in actual fact, that's the reality.
I don't think the Sweden Democrats are neo-Nazis. Of course they're not. They're definitely not. No, they've increased 7% of their vote anyway. We're not talking about neo-Nazis in Sweden.
There is a legitimate reason
for people to vote for people who want to limit migration.
There's a spectrum, isn't there? There's a spectrum, and of course this is a problem all over the world. As the world economy crashes, as wars are created in the Middle East that shouldn't be happening.
It's very easy to just, you know, slur them as neo-Nazis. A lot of people do that.
The fringe of the far right in Sweden is definitely neo-Nazi. Those who are putting this stuff forward, they're not centre-right, Tony. They're not like Jeff Gollop, our conservative leader we spoke to earlier.
They're
much nastier than that.
But I think we just have to be realistic.
Yeah, you do.
Say, for example, are UKIP neo-Nazis?
No, but then UKIP aren't quite as right-wing as some of these Sweden Democrats, I'm afraid. What there is actually...
You can say some of, but no, some
in,
of UKIP
in Scandinavia are. In general, there's always been a very strong left-wing tradition, but the downside of that is you've also got a very strong and very motivated right wing.
But anyway, what about these kind of news stories of violence generated, whether it's terrorism or street fighting in the run-up to elections nowadays?
Well, I mean, there's been social tension in all countries in the world as a result of the financial crash and all the rest of it. There's, you know, people feel threatened. Their jobs are at stake. They worry about their healthcare. They worry about housing. They worry about social change. Immigrants, whatever you think of them, create disruption in terms of being integrated and so on. And you know, there's
it's mainly to do with erosion of wages and paying conditions.
Well, it's not just that. It's not just
that's the main reason.
That's
the main reason.
It's also cultural.
That is the main reason. I can tell you, if you look around the world, particularly Europe, obviously, the main reason that the people are mobilised, particularly I spoke to a lot of people when I was in Germany a few years ago, is what it is mainly about, is they see their wages falling and they see other people taking their jobs for far less money.
All right. Well, there's an element of that, Tony, but there's also an element of it, I'm afraid, in more white... We're used to having people of all kinds of social backgrounds here. Muslims are integrated pretty much in this country, but they're not in Scandinavia because they're not used to it. They never had an empire, and most of these people who've turned up very, very recently, and frankly, some people just ain't used to having people around that don't look like them and think like them.
Now let's go back to have a little look at the Middle East, and as I promised, and we didn't do it last week, but we'll do it again this week. It's a kind of wander around the Israeli cabinet. Tonight it's the turn of Avigdor Lieberman, who's the Netanyahu's defense minister.
As one my colleague said in the past, we have three problems: Iran, Iran, and Iran. First of all, Iran as a state that they are trying to undermine stability in all our region, not only regarding Israel. You see what happens in Yemen and their activity in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Syria, and you have an annual report of State Department regarding the terror in the world. No doubt, according to this report, it's the biggest sponsor of terror in the world. And of course, Iran, with their support and their activity to create proxies around Israel. We have Hezbollah, we have Islamic Jihad, we have Hamas. All of them not able to exist without Iranian support even 1 week. It should be clear that 80%, 85% of all budget of Hezbollah comes from Iranians. And of course, their direct threat to wipe out all the state of Israel We saw Iranians after signing the agreement 5+1 and Iran after the nuclear deal. We saw the parade in Tehran with missiles, with inscriptions in Hebrew to destroy the state of Israel. We see every year a competition for the best cartoon denial of Holocaust with the first prize $50,000. And Iran is trying to turn all Syria to be forward-based against Israel.
And they want a war with us, you think?
And they are doing some concrete steps, and we're not ready to allow. We will prevent at any cost from Iranian to establish forward base against Israel on Syrian soil.
I want to ask you about the Russian intention and their announcement just a few days ago that they plan to move the S-300. The S-300, for those who don't know, is one of the most advanced surface-to-air missile defense systems in the world and would potentially significantly undermine Israel's aerial superiority and operational freedom over Syria as well as other places. What will we do? What will Israel do if the S-300 is delivered to the Syrian military in Syria?
Again, only to clarify our position, we keep really for us freedom of operation in all Syria. And we don't have any intention not to attack the Russians and even not to interfere in the domestic issues of Syria. But if somebody thinks that it's possible to launch missiles to attack Israel or even our aircrafts, no doubt we will respond, and we respond very forcefully.
So if the S-300 is used against Israeli aircraft, we will take action?
No doubt we will take the action.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because they've got no right to overfly Syria whatsoever. It's like us discussing what we would do if the Russians tried to shoot our planes down as we flew over Russia. And, of course, the Russians would have an absolute right to shoot our planes down. So it's just a load of nonsense, really, in terms of international law. The other thing about Lieberman, which I know, is in actual fact he was born in Romania. And we were just talking about immigration there earlier. And as you know, quite a few people in Britain voted for Brexit because they don't want people from Romania coming to live here because we've got enough people already. But of course, the Palestinian Arabs who live in Palestine have to put up with people like Lieberman, who's basically Romanian. He's Romanian. He wasn't born in Israel. He's there as the defense minister, and he's very hard line. He said that Palestinian members of the Israeli Knesset should be assassinated. He's very hardline. We didn't hear him saying his very hardline stuff there, but he's a famously hardline guy. Although, as I say, he's not actually from Palestine. He's Romanian. But because he's Jewish, he's got a right to come there. Can you imagine if you're a Palestinian Arab and most of your people have been driven off to live in other countries nearby? You can't go back to where you were born. But anybody from all over the world, if they claim to be Jewish, can just walk in and run a whole army that sits on top of your head. Talking about immigration, people are pretty worried about immigration all over the world, Tony. Palestinian Arabs are worried about it as well, because they turn up with guns.
What about the bigger picture here, though? Because we've got a few sort of difficulties coming along, haven't we? What with the potential financial situation with Brexit? Can you just give us your take a step back from all of this? And as Brexit happens, it looks as if there's going to be no deal. I think most people looking at that now will say the realistic option is going to be no deal. What will happen to politics in terms of elections here and that sort of thing? And also, what would happen to the economy?
Well, I mean, the no dealers have been saying, oh, we can always have WTO rules. But you've got to realise that the Americans have sabotaged the WTO and about to blow it up. So we won't be able to have WTO rules because that's going to be chaos. There's going to be a trade war.
The Americans can't do that on their own.
No, they've been doing it slowly. They've been trying to get rid of it for years because they don't like multilateral discussions. They just want to dictate. Yeah, that's what they want. and we will be caught up in a trade war between the EU and the Americans, and we'll have to take a side. And if we take the American side, then the EU will put tariffs on our goods, because they're not going to see the UK used as a Trojan horse to undermine the EU.
Well, it's already pretty clear that we are going to be taking the American side.
I
mean, if all you need to do, all we need to do is to listen to, for example, the BBC, both in their domestic and their international coverage. We're seeing more and more Americans, not only American commentators on British issues, American reporters around the world giving reports. So it seems pretty clear that US influence through organisations like the British American Project for the Successor Generation, which is a group which brings what they call opinion formers in Britain and America together. These are the people now telling us what to think, effectively, and a lot of them are American. Most of the Europeans that used to have some sort of role in that are now out of the window.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact is that even if you wanted to do trade deal with the Americans, it's not that easy. I often say to people, when was the Doha round completed of the WTO negotiations?
But don't the Americans see us, surely the Americans see us now as a satellite in a similar way to Brussels used to?
They do, but we're not. And in actual fact, it's not clear that you can get a deal. I was just pointing out, it's a joke, when was the Doha round completed? It wasn't completed, because trade deals take 15 to 20 years minimum. The idea that you can just go round and sign up trade deals with people is basically infantile. The real world doesn't work like that. And if we have a no-deal Brexit, the pound will tank, interest rates will rise, the property market will crash, and then we'll have a general election and a Corbyn government. That's what's going to happen.
You think that'll be when?
Oh, if the Brexit stuff fails, the traders will smell blood in the water straight away. Straight away, and the pound will go down.
And you think the traders will give the Conservatives the opportunity to just walk away and allow Jeremy Corbyn in?
No. What they will do is sell the pound to make money for themselves, because it's a one-way bet. If everybody else is steaming for the exit, if you've positioned yourself correctly, like George Soros did on Black Wednesday, you can make a fortune. And that's what they will do. And in order to do that, they will have to sell the pound, which they will happily do. And when they do that, Hammond will have to raise interest rates to protect the pound, just as the Argentinians have had to do, just as the Turks will be forced to do unless they talk to the Russians. And when you do that, your housing market collapses. And all those people who thought they were in favour of Brexit lose their life savings. They're going to be less enamoured of the government than they were. And that will certainly make it very difficult in marginal constituencies for the Tory party. I mean, as you know, Tony, I'm opposed to Brexit. But if we have a hard Brexit, we are going to put the people who are in favour of it against the wall, and we're going to say, right, you're 100% responsible for this. You're going to take 100% of the blame. We take no blame for it whatsoever. You will now take the blame if we have a recession in Britain, which isn't part of a general recession in the world, and that's a big if. It may be that they will be able to hide behind the fact that everybody else is going down at the same time. But it may well be that we will be the first over the edge, which will be clearly to do with Brexit. And that means those who wanted Brexit will have to take the blame for it. They can go to the electorate and explain why they've lost it. We're going to lose the car industry. That's pretty clear.
I think the car industry made absolutely clear.
Okay, if we've got no-deal Brexit, we're taking the car industry
elsewhere.
Can I just
say, we lost the car industry when it was sold to foreign investors,
well,
actually.
Well, those foreign investors...
And the last British... I mean, I can remember Jeremy Paxman on Newsnight, when it used to be worth watching, saying something about the very last British Reliant... the Robin Reliant was the last British car actually to be made, and then they had to close their plant down, and there were no more British cars. So it's an illusion to think
there is still car production going on in Britain.
Yes,
but
the decision about whether it is made in Britain or not, it's not made here, is it?
No,
it's made elsewhere.
No, it's not. That's right. And of course, the Land Rover already said they're going to Slovakia. And that's what will happen. They will do that. And of course, that will mean and of course, the Brexiteers say, well, we'll get some other industries.
But, I mean,
let's just try and recycle this a little bit,
because you're being a bit disingenuous here. What we were saying earlier was that this 2008 crash and the so-called solution of QE to it was actually going to inevitably lead to a crash at some point and the longer it gets left, the worse that crash would be, and the more that in the interim, wealth would have been funneled away from ordinary people into the hands of the super rich and the Soroses and the speculators. Yes. So surely, if Brexit causes that crash, that's no bad thing.
No, but I think politically, you tell me, what's the politics of this? If there is a British Brexit crash, those who are in favour of Brexit, including the right wing of the Tory party, will pay the political price. They will. Because people will realise who's responsible and they won't vote for them anymore. So that's the positive thing from a Labour point of view. Come on, walk onto the punch, smash. Oh dear, that's your blood all over your shirt. That's what will happen.
What about another conflict which we haven't mentioned really very much tonight, and you mentioned it briefly, is Ukraine, because the US ambassador said that the Americans are drastically to expand their military assistance to Ukraine. That's this week he said that. Ambassador Kurt Volker, US will drastically expand military assistance to Ukraine, upping the ante in Ukraine. Why now?
Why now? Because of what's going on in Idlib and everywhere else. I mean, Zakarenko was murdered this week, hardly covered in the Western media, but the leader of an independent state, murdered by a bomb, an improvised explosive device. They have blamed the Ukrainians. But do you know whose hand I suspect in that? British intelligence services and special forces. Now, of course, they may eventually be able to put together an extradition request for some British personnel to go to Donbass to stand trial for killing their leader. And of course, the reason why it's happening now is because some people in the Pentagon think it's now or never in terms of stopping Russia and China. And they're mad, but who can stop them?
Good question. So that's time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8 now. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour. That's Jeff Gollop and Liz Lation. And also you just heard Martin Summers, Old Age Oxford Economist. That's just to show Dialects on Tuesday at noon. It's online now at dialectradio.co.uk. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or the iPlayer or anywhere you like. You find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at the website thisweekoneword.org.uk, where you can comment, complain, say whatever you want on there on the WordPress site. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy Quain's Saturday edition at 10 a.m. tomorrow, The Real Musical Deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.